and it will not be necessary for me to introduce him to you at length. I just want to say that he does represent to us as one of the last important phenomena of the 19th century. I understand he was born on the very last day of the 19th century. He was educated at Trinity College at Cambridge and began his career as a missionary in South India at Travancore and Tinnevelly. After a service of some 6 years, he became professor at the Theological College at Nazareth, South India, where our colleague Dr. Thiel visited only a few weeks ago. He became bishop of Tinnevelly, and after 6 years, he returned to his homeland, a lecturer at Cambridge, and from there, many other places, including Toronto, Berkeley, California, at the Pacific School of Religion, Buenos Aires, Melbourne, Glasgow. It sounds almost like the itinerary for Pan American. During this time, he was also author of very many books, a small percentage of those, and still a large number, as you know, are on display in a special exhibit in our library. He is presently, or I should say that the publications also have almost a full range of theology, not only ecumenism and mission, but the biblical theology, systematic theology, and historical theology. And we'll call missions and ecumenism practical theology so that we have all four fields taken care of. He is presently professor of missions and ecumenical theology at the University of Hamburg. He will speak to us this morning as on the missionary of the future, the Right Reverend Stephen Charles Neal.
Gentlemen, it gives me particular satisfaction to be able to address you this morning. Some years ago, in a group of friends, I was perhaps waxing a little unduly boastful about my ecumenical achievements and all the various seminaries I had visited in the United States, the Dutch Reformed at Holland, Michigan, the Presbyterians at Richmond, Virginia, the Methodists at Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia, Disciples of Christ at Enid, Oklahoma, and one friend said, well, there is one seminary in the United States in which you will never be asked to lecture. Well, you guessed the answer. Well, about 3 days later, the telephone rang, long distance call. This is Danker, Professor of Missions at Concordia Seminary. I said, oh yes, I know all about you. Could you come and give one or two lectures to the students? I said, sure. And my mind went back to that well-known Anglican hymn, which I'm glad to find you have in your hymnal, God moves in a mysterious way in wonders of our form. But you're not allowed to read on that hymn to the point at which it says, behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. So it is great pleasure that I find myself here unexpectedly. And I ask myself, how is it that I here feel so completely at home? The answer can only be that there's a very deep bond between us, which I can have to express in these words. A deep desire in all things to be obedient to Jesus Christ. If we come to definitions, there will certainly be certain things which divide us, or certain things we would need to discuss, certain things on which perhaps we would have to agree to differ, but all these differences are within the broad overarching unity of trust in our Lord Jesus Christ, the desire to love him more and to serve him better. My theme, as you have heard, is the missionary of the future. And this may seem at the outset to raise a very significant question: are there going to be any missionaries in the future? That large question mark is posed to us primarily by communist China. That was the greatest of all American mission fields. Lives, money, generosity, service were poured into that country for just over a century, and then suddenly the collapse came. Now, there is not one single foreign missionary left in the country, with the possible exception of one or two Roman Catholics serving long prison sentences. I suppose we may take it for granted that certainly in my lifetime, and probably in the lifetime of the youngest of you here present, it will be impossible for any foreigner to serve as an emissary of Jesus Christ in that country. That is the most shattering question mark against our traditional missionary program. Other countries seem to be following the same line. For Burma, it is almost impossible for any new missionary to obtain a visa, and almost impossible for a missionary who leaves the country to return. In Indonesia, the government makes endless difficulties for those wishing to serve as Christian missionaries. The government of India does not make it exactly easy, so there are some possibilities of getting in. If you wish to go to India as a missionary, you have to show that there is something you can do which cannot be done by any Indian Christian. So I tell our students in Hamburg they must learn Babylonish and Ugaritic. We can then point out that it is essential for our Indian theological students that they should be able to learn Babylonish and Ugaritic, and unfortunately there is so far no Indian capable of teaching those languages. Then the visa may be forthcoming. Now, other countries may follow suit. The area of our missionary operations may be signally restricted in your lifetime and mine. Of course, the word missionary does not necessarily mean white Westerner. One of the joyful new features of the situation is that younger churches are themselves becoming missionary. The Church of South India has representatives in Thailand. The churches in the Philippines are showing notable vigor in this matter, sending representatives quite far afield. The whole aspect and scope of missionary operations may change. Yet still, there is the question: will this be possible at all? From another angle, the whole of our traditional missionary operation is threatened by the attitude of the younger churches. In a considerable number of areas, the feeling quite unmistakably is no more missionaries. And when the missionaries were driven out of China, beyond all doubt, the Chinese Christians, even the most friendly and loyal of them, felt a certain sense of relief. Now we can be ourselves. It's very nice to have guests in the home, but when the guest departs, the family heaves a slight sigh of relief. Now it will no longer be necessary to be quite so polite and quite so clean and orderly. We can just be ourselves again in the family. In the same way, when the foreigner was there, the Chinese, with their elaborate courtesy, always felt themselves to be playing up a little to a foreign body. Now there's a sense we can be, for the first time, a genuinely Chinese church. They know their weaknesses, they know the enormous difficulties of living under the hostile communist government, yet in one sense they feel that they are the true Christians in the world. They know the enemy, they are free from any dependence on anything outside the church and the gospel. They have the opportunity, as we have not, with our implication in state relationships, in the politics of our country, to manifest the true essence of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In other areas, too, the same phenomenon is observable. It has to be noted, with regret and not for quotation, that in the famous Batak Church in Sumatra, the third great festival of the church's year, after Christmas and Easter, is the liberation of the Batak Church. That does not mean liberation from the Japanese or the Dutch, but from the missionaries. Where missionary control has been most rigorously exercised, and for too long a period, there is always that reaction. Let them go and let us be ourselves. And this again certainly takes place in other areas of the world, though let it be said about our church once again, welcoming foreigners to work in the church structure, though under very strict limitations, that they shall not interfere in any church business, and they shall have no responsible position within the church order itself. In spite of these two great question marks, I believe there is a future for the missionary, for the foreigner, the expatriate, who works in a country other than his own in the name of Jesus Christ, as he signs that the situation is gradually changing. When I was a young missionary, I think our Indian friends were saying quite clearly, no more missionaries, you started it all, thank you very much, now you can all go home and we take over. And having taken over, they're perhaps beginning to feel that the load is heavier than they expected, and there is need to call to the brethren in the other boats to come over and lend a hand. This was the turning point reached perhaps at the Whitby Missionary Conference of 1947, Whitby, Ontario, the first missionary conference after the war. There we said to our friends from the younger churches, the question of the full spiritual equality and independence of the younger churches is no longer even a subject for discussion. It is granted, axiomatic and self-evident. Now tell us what your plans are for the total evangelization of your countries. There was an embarrassed pause. It was perfectly clear that with the exception of the Koreans, not one of our representatives of the younger churches had ever thought in those terms. They'd been battling for the independence of the church, and how did they see the church? And this is where we have taught them so badly, given them a static organizational picture of the church and not a dynamic, aggressive understanding of the church. A mutual insurance society for the believers. At the worst, jobs for the boys and a spear for the exercise of authority and dominion. And there, alas, we see ourselves reflected. When this challenge was put to them, they were wholly unready for it. At the moment, I don't think the penny dropped, but gradually I believe the message of Whitby is taking hold. The question is not whether the Indian churches can be free and independent, they are. The question is, how do the 3% of Christians in India undertake the evangelization of the other 97%? The proportion differs in different countries. You see, the old slogan of John Armott, the evangelization of the world in this generation, is not without its relevance even today. That slogan has been dropped, partly because the Germans misunderstood it, thought evangelization meant the same as conversion, and of course no sensible man ever supposed the whole world could be converted in a generation. The point is, can the gospel be made available by your generation to the corresponding generation in India, Thailand, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, and all the other countries of the earth? It's not just a question of a very far distant eschatological future, when the command to preach the gospel to every creature may be fulfilled, but of immediate, present, daily responsibility, each Christian generation being in the sight of God responsible for the non-Christian generation that is contemporaneous with it. Once this picture of the church dawns and is taken seriously, the whole missionary perspective alters. An American friend told me he was visiting Ghana some years ago, talking to the very distinguished General Secretary of the Christian Council of Ghana, Peter Dagadu, whose untimely death was a great loss to us all. He said, "Mr. Dagadu, what percentage of people in Ghana are Christians?" The answer at that time was roughly 22%, a little more than one-fifth. The American friend said, "Why do you not give up this endless business of girding at the missionaries and asserting your own independence? Is it not time to move forward to the third stage," he borrowed that expression from me, "from the age of subservience to the missionary, through the second stage of rivalry and self-assertion, to the period of peaceful cooperation for the proclamation of the gospel to the entire population of the country." I think again of that great country, Nigeria, where you, like us, have interests. They claim a population of 50 million. I think that's an exaggeration. It must be at least 40 million, the most populous country in Africa. Not long ago, a report stated when I was in Nigeria that the population is composed of 35% Muslims, 60% pagans and 5% Christians. I guess it's about right for Muslims. I'm sure it's a grave underestimate of Christians, who are probably 15% of the population, may even be more. Many claim to be Christian who are not directly in touch with any organized church. But even so, that leaves 20 million pagans as the Christian problem in that country, not taking into account the duty of evangelizing also the Muslims. Perhaps half those 20 million are in some sense covered by the existing missionary organizations. That still leaves 10 million, quite a considerable population, as a pioneer field within which the gospel has to be preached in our generation if we take this principle seriously. We've been told a good many times lately of the threat of Islam in Africa. You read constantly in missionary periodicals that five times as many people are becoming Muslims in Africa as are becoming Christians. I believe that to be wholly untrue, except for certain quite small areas, but this is something also we have to take into account. I've been pleading for years for a survey, tribe by tribe, and there are many, many hundreds of tribes in tropical Africa, to show which tribes have already been Islamized, which have been in some degree Christianized, and which still remain untouched by either the Gospel or the Quran. I don't know the answer. The survey is just being started by a young friend of mine who, after taking his doctorate at Columbia with distinction and using his scientific training before he turned to theology, is going to begin this kind of survey. We may find there are many hundreds of tribes to which the Gospel ought to be sent now, before Islam spreads, takes over, and as you know, when a tribe has been Islamized, the process of attempting to bring the gospel to it is 20 times as difficult as if it is still in its untouched pagan condition. Now, if the African churches can undertake such an operation, all good wishes to them, but if they look at this seriously, with their gigantic tasks in the areas already covered, the shepherding of the millions who now call themselves Christians, they might well say, come over and help us. This task is too great for us. We need your help. Come and let us work together in the vineyard of the Lord. If so, the missionary is not primarily somebody sent by a missionary organization in St. Louis, Missouri, but someone called by the Church of Jesus Christ in Nigeria or Togo or Thailand or Korea, whatever it is. The primary thing is the call from Macedonia, and what we offer is response. Now, it is interesting that we are just beginning to hear these tones coming from our friends, the leaders in the younger churches. So we say, you would like missionaries? Tell us more. What kind of missionaries do you want? And here again, the answer we begin to hear is rather surprising. We want missionaries who will stay. As one of the African bishops put it picturesquely not long ago, we want missionaries who will lay their bones here. He is not suggesting a return to more primitive African or South Sea practice, when the missionaries did literally lay their bones in those areas. Now, this is a very interesting change. Until quite recently, these friends were saying, send us a few experts who will come perhaps for 2 or 3 years do a specific job, to set up a library for our theological school, or to give expert teaching in the interim period. Now they are saying, send us people who will stay and will become part of the church they serve. A friend not long ago pointed out to me the great advantage which the Roman Catholics have with their practice of celibacy and therefore continuity. He works in Uganda. He says, hardly a week passes that you see in the Uganda press, here is a picture of Sister Serafina, who has just died at the age of 84 after 60 years of unbroken service in Uganda, in which she never returned to her homeland at all. Here is Father Jerome Xavier, who has just celebrated his sacerdotal jubilee, ordained in Uganda in 1914, just before the First World War. He has only twice returned to his native Luxembourg. That gives a permanence which we, on the whole, on the Protestant side, gravely lack. What is the average length of service in African mission fields? I believe it to be somewhere about 7 years, and that is far too little. Longer in countries better climates, Unfortunately, many missionary societies still live in the 19th century, some live in the 18th. They don't seem to have noticed the invention of the aeroplane, and the fact that you can keep missionaries in service even in bad climates if you make proper arrangements to hold a family together with the problems of education by a reasonable use of the facilities of air travel, which is expensive, but far less expensive than this rapid turnover of missionaries giving a few years of their lives, and 7, 10, 12, and then being lost just when they become really useful. Now, it's interesting, as I say, that this comes from the side of our younger church friends, send us those who will stay. Then we ask, what do you want them for? The answer now is for practically everything. The task is becoming so great, the weight so heavy, that there are few areas into which we cannot fit the expatriate if he is the right kind of man and woman. And here again, another message of Whitby is just beginning to penetrate. In one of those very significant and surprisingly brief reports, speaking of the integration of the overseas worker into the churches he serves, we wrote, he will be eligible for any position of service, authority or dignity to which he may be called by the church which he serves. We believed in real equality, that the missionary is there to serve in any capacity which his natural gifts fit him, and if those natural gifts fit him for leadership, then the church ought to accept and welcome those gifts. And here again one notices the change. Our Archbishop in Uganda told me that African friends were just beginning to say to him, when you have a post to fill, don't look at the colour of a man's skin. We want the man who can do the job. Now, there's a very faint whisper still. The general emphasis is exactly the opposite. Every position of importance must be filled by the national, qualified or unqualified. It's just beginning to change. Friends have said to me, and I think this is true, a second-class Indian or African can do a better job than a first-class European or American. A third-class Indian or African cannot. And if it is a choice, don't imagine for a moment that is always the case. We have many, thank God, first-class Indians, Africans, Chinese and others. But if a choice is between a first-class expatriate who is available and a third-class national, the feeling of the church is just beginning to be, let us accept the gifts God has given, regardless of a man's background and the colour of his skin. An interesting phenomenon, which may have come to your notice, is the election of Bishop Leslie Newbegin to be Bishop of Madras in the Church of South India, which has from the beginning practiced this principle of equality. It is interesting that two dioceses previously, with absolutely free elections, elected Westerners. But it's not altogether a compliment to us. It means, lamentably, that in certain areas, tension between different groups, and this in India, I'm afraid, means different castes, was so strong that the obvious middleman was the European. That was overruled by the synod on technical grounds, and Indian bishops put in, this time, with a particularly difficult diocese to fill, Madras's great metropolis, with all the problems we are familiar with in the West, and a few extra ones, they concluded that the right and best man was this very experienced, very gifted, very godly Westerner, which Newbegin has accepted the position, will be leaving Geneva and the World Council to go back to his missionary work, which he so dearly loved, called, chosen, and appointed, not by any Western authority whatsoever, but by a free church in a free election, expressing their opinion as to God's will. Very well, then, we are prepared to accept missionaries for any office in the church which they may be called, but in what relationship? And here is a very important point. If you ask an African leader, do you want missionaries, he is quite likely to say emphatically, no. Do you want Western colleagues, equally emphatically, yes. I mentioned in another lecture that the word mission and missionary is so weighted by false associations and pictures from the past, that it is hardly possible to use the word at all today. To so many of our friends, the missionary represents always the alien who is controlled from some other place, who still has his roots in the West, and feels himself responsible not to the church where he lives and works, but to some missionary society, which quite often is not even a church body, in some remote land of the West. One of our Anglican African bishops complained just the other day, "I have a diocese for which I'm responsible. I have here Western colleagues. I suddenly find that in some entirely different place from where I supposed them to be, I find they've been transferred by the central mission authority." Now, this refers only to the women workers. The ordained minister is directly under his bishop, cannot be moved without his knowledge. But even if it applies to women workers, teachers and schools and so on, the fact that they can be moved like pawns on the board by some remote authority, or I'm saying in this case by a fairly near authority, the mission headquarters in the country concerned, that makes the position of the church and the indigenous leader absolutely impossible. In that sense, no missionary is desired. Mission boards are terribly slow to learn this lesson. The idea that a board, however sympathetic and able, in a mission centre in the West, can simply assign a new missionary. When a missionary returns from furlough, assign him some different place or job, this is absolutely detestable from the point of view of the younger church, and it will not be tolerated. Rather than endure such indignities, they will just do without us. If he comes, he must belong. He must feel his roots here from the first day. This is his home. The whole problem of identification. How do you identify yourself with this local church where you serve? Well, some people try to do it by wearing the dress of the country, by adopting the food of the country, and various external methods. This was the method of the China Inland Mission in China. I think at that date, 100 years ago, with the intense anti-foreign feeling of the Chinese, that was probably right and desirable. In India in my day, I wore Indian dress a great deal. I was very happy with Indian food. I let it be known, I was very happy to be entertained in the homes of my Indian friends, but I would not make it a rule or a principle. And our Indian friends very often said, "For you to do this is play acting and fancy dress." So many of us now wear Western dress. It seems to us rather absurd that you should make a point of pretending to be Indians, which you are not and never can be. These external things can have value at certain points. Identification is a far deeper and more subtle matter. One of the great roots to identification, of course, is the language. When I was a young missionary, Indians on the whole discouraged us from learning any Indian language. They said they're difficult, you never speak them well, we all speak English, don't bother. I regret to say that many of my older colleagues had followed this advice. At one time, I was the only man missionary in the whole diocese of Tinnevelly able to preach in Tamil, which I think was a grave mistake. Now, with the revival of national pride and consciousness, which means also pride in the local languages, missionaries are being urged to learn the language, and I believe this is essential as a key to fellowship, a great road of access to that inner contact and understanding which are so important. But far more vital even than that, is just the sense of belonging. I put it in this way, that the moment the missionary lands on the shores of the country where he is to serve, he ceases to be a missionary. He becomes member, servant, and minister of that church in which he lives. On his return to his own country, he becomes a missionary again, in reverse direction. He is a missionary from the younger church to his home church, in whose interests and in whose name he is authorized to speak. But we must go a little further. As in one sense, they just don't want missionaries, in the sense of those who are planted and imposed. But if we ask, in what character do they come? Rather surprisingly, they say, the missionary must be a missionary. And what do they mean by that? They jump over a generation or two. In recent years, what they've seen in us all too often has been administrators and financiers. Men and women sitting in offices, controlling, directing, organizing, and unfortunately many of the younger church leaders
copyist in that as in other things and thinks that that's what it means to be a missionary. Others jumping over that generation to an earlier one, when they say that a missionary must be a missionary, they mean a missionary man or woman must be man or woman consumed with a passion for the glorification of the name of God in Jesus Christ. I'm afraid you will often find me very old-fashioned. If I can find new terms for what I want to say, I'll use them. If I can't, I go back to the old ones. The old expression was the passion for souls. That may sound terribly pietistic. If you can better it, do so. But let what you say mean the same. What, after all, do we cross the ocean for? What is our purpose in making this journey to a distant land? Unless there is that profound and eager desire that Christ shall be lifted up, that men and women shall see him and turn to him for their salvation, would it not be better to stay at home? That is a new emphasis. Of course, experts are needed. Experts are needed for our great Indian colleges to teach chemistry and physics and English literature. Experts are needed for our theological schools teach elementary Greek and systematics. But now the emphasis is changing. Whatever you do, whatever your specific technical, professional vocation, unless absolutely central is the desire that men and women, students, boys and girls, should be one for Jesus Christ, you better not be there at all. Now, of course, the teacher is not a propagandist. The professor in a college must have an academic conscience. He has no business to use his time in the classroom for anything else except the teaching of the subject he is commissioned to teach. And as I say, maybe business methods, journalism, physics, chemistry, history, anything else. But unless there shines through him this inner central purpose, what is he doing? In hospital again. I warned yesterday against the danger of our using our hospitals, our orphanages, and other charitable institutions as a kind of bait, as a kind of lever to lift people almost against their will into the kingdom. That must be avoided. But unless in the conduct and habit of the doctor, the sympathy and gentleness of the nurses, the charity of Jesus Christ shines through, if there is merely technical competence, will they not find that better and more completely in the government hospital? What are we really doing? So if we press them further and say, now, break this down a little, tell us the qualities that you believe to be essential for this manifestation of the true evangelic missionary spirit, I think we will give four more detailed answers. What do you expect to see in a missionary? The first answer is holiness. A terrifying demand, but are they not justified in making it? They say, what has come out of your 12 or 14 centuries of Christianity? If we cannot see in you visibly likeness to Christ, what has the gospel done for you in all these centuries? You see, it is the principle of incarnation. When God wanted to reveal himself to us, he revealed himself visibly in a life. The Swiss commentator Wilhelm Fischer, commenting on the first utterance of God in Scripture, let there be light, says the meaning is Kelomova. Let one see me, literally. Let me be seen. What is the light? Not just an entity in itself, but that physical, intellectual, and spiritual light through which God can be seen. If we have understood that in Genesis 1, you see it's all there already implicit, is the principle of the incarnation, not just the so-called post-evangelium, earlier than that, the story of the creation, and when the Word was made flesh, and lived among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory of a carpenter, the glory of a Jew, the glory of a poor man, the glory of a wanderer, the glory of a servant. Then we came to know what God is. In your country, in a church known to me, is the most splendid tribute I think I have ever read to a Christian man. It is an Episcopal church of St. George in New York, a simple tablet put up by some children in memory of their father, and at the foot of the tablet are simple words, "In him they saw their heavenly Father." Blessed be the parents whom children can give such a testimonial as that. And unless, with all our imperfections, selfishness, idleness, neglect of God and His Spirit, unless something of Jesus Christ becomes visible in us, how shall they know and believe? The second demand is that one who would work as a missionary must have a very deep personal acquaintance with the interior life. And this emphasis comes from the younger churches themselves, because they are well aware of the terrible superficiality of life in most of these younger churches. We romanticize, idealize these younger churches. It's a great shock to the young missionary to find out what they're really like. And of course, the missionary who writes home doesn't want to seem to be criticizing or running down his own beloved people. He tends to give the lights rather than the shadows. And our younger church representatives, when they come among us, rightly and properly, with their own national and personal pride, try to give us the most favorable picture of what is happening. There is the other side. And with the emphasis on organization, the weighty organization we have imposed upon them, the conditions of life in countries like India and Japan, where there's so little privacy, Christian life tends to be lived on a very superficial level. And they say of us, "Can you not show us something more? Can you not show us the way to deeper secrets of the intimacy of the inward Christian life?" In the area where I worked, many, many devoted missionaries have worked. An ancient church, as I was pointing out to another group, the first church register of what was later my cathedral, goes back to the year 1780, a great apostolic succession of faithful men and women who have lived and preached and worked, but only two stand out vividly in the memory of this younger church. The famous Walker Tinnabelli, who died in 1912, would never accept any invitation in the evening, because the last hour of every day from 9 to 10 was given to God, and again in the morning, not later than 6 at the very latest, he would again be on his knees. Life is lived very much in public in those countries. Everybody knows what you do. Everybody knows whether you live on your knees or not. The greatness of our very great Bishop Azariah, the first Indian bishop of the Anglican Church in India, was that he had learnt from those old devout missionaries the secret of the inner life. He once told me, just in passing in conversation, that he prayed every morning by name for everybody who held responsible office in his diocese. There must have been at least 50 people, apart from other personal and church intercession. He was up by 4:30 every morning. He was on his knees by 5. If you want to be reckoned virtuous Christian in India, you have to be up early in the morning, and even 7:30 classes will be regarded as an indulgence rather than a discipline. And this great and good man kept up this practice of deep inner fellowship with God in Christ at the very end of his life. The other of the two stand out vividly, lived much earlier, died in 1858, the time of his death, after 13 short years of service in India. He was senior fellow of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, having given up his academic career of distinction, become a wandering evangelist among the villages in India. He too was a man of intense concentration in prayer, and living in a tent, he found it embarrassing to be too long on his knees. It would hinder the servants who wanted to do the work of the tent and the preparation for the day's work. So quite often he would sit at the door of his tent with little slips of paper in front of him and write down his intercessions. After his death, hundreds of these little slips of paper were found. He poured out his heart to God, writing in order to save others embarrassment and finding there a ready method of expression for his inner feelings. When he died, nothing seemed to have come of it. It was a barren area. Apparently, there was very little response. Years after his death, an astonishing movement broke out among the women in the place where he lies buried. It had to be semi-secret. Wealthy women, the wives of traders in a great trading ring all over South India, for some persecution at first, then these women could be baptized semi-secretly, slip out to church very early in the morning or late at night. They were served by two wonderful women, sisters, quite elderly even when I got to India. They were said to be difficult to work with. As a young missionary, I found no difficulty whatsoever. They simply asked if you loved the Lord, and if they got the impression that you did, then you are in. And Miss Alice told me many, many years ago that she had on her prayer list the names of 400 women converts. Each time I went, the church seemed to be fuller, and then the daughters got married. I was baptizing and confirming the daughters, and then the granddaughters of the original converts. An amazing movement of which nothing could be written, but of course to stir up fierce opposition, so there isn't known of it, but here seems to be the fruit of the prayers and the life of this good man, which seemed to end in failure with little done, and yet there, far later, was the fruit. The third quality they look for is humility. They say, this is extremely difficult for you, because all you Westerners have an inbred arrogance, which is quite intolerable, and of which you are yourselves largely unconscious. I'm afraid that's true. We have been taught that we are the leading peoples of the world, and even when we go out as missionaries, and we reckon by going out to lead. That's what we've often been taught in seminary and missionary preparation, and they see in us racial arrogance, of the white against the black, even when we think we've freed ourselves from it, the arrogance of the older church in relation to the younger, the arrogance of those who think they are to lead rather than to serve. It takes a tremendous amount to cure ourselves of this, and we never do it perfectly. But this is all the more necessary because we have taught them so much of our arrogance. We've talked a tremendous amount in the last 40 years about training leadership in the younger churches. Anyone who lives in Germany reacts very unfavorably to that term because of the Führerprinzip, on the basis of which Hitler carried out his abomination. They know that they have to learn the form of a servant if they're really to follow Jesus Christ. They ask us to show the way, and difficult as it is, we have to try to learn the secret. Show them the humility and the meekness of Christ. Take on us the form of a servant, in order they too may learn it and follow him. And finally, as a missionary of today, man or woman, must have a great gift of patience. Things don't happen quickly. You have to be prepared for the long haul. This is true in all pioneer areas. In South India, a century ago, the American Baptist Mission was commonly known as the Lone Star Mission because in 20 years it had made only one convert. I think that's not strictly historically true. I think there were five, but that doesn't make much difference to the tale. The story is that the missionaries met on a hilltop one day to pray and ask whether they should not leave this barren district and go elsewhere. Frustrated by the long years of waiting when faithfulness seemed to have met with so little reward, they said, we'll move and go elsewhere. And the Lord seemed to say, no, this is where I've put you, stay where you are. And they said, we'll stay. Almost immediately, one of the great mass movements broke out in their midst. For 20 years, they had gone to the higher caste, as all missions have started by doing, thinking that the higher castes are one, they will bring in the lower caste in their train. God's method of working seems to be the opposite. They'd never thought of the possibility of such a movement among these terribly poor, underprivileged, hungry, depraved people. God began to bring them in their hundreds and their thousands, in one of the great movements of church history. Charles de Foucault has left a glowing memory in the Roman Catholic Church. A converted cavalry officer who had sinned greatly in his youth and seemed to want ever to seek greater hardship and greater humiliation in the service of the Christ whose love and service he had adopted. He ended his life far in the Sahara at Taman Rasset among the wild Tuareg, often completely alone, sometimes with one companion. He received special permission from the Pope to celebrate Mass alone without even a server, a privilege very rarely given, and there he lived, among these wild Muslims, with no opportunity of speech or proclamation that would once have created a riot, just to be there, to pray, to love, to show something of the reality of Jesus Christ, what the French call so expressively, présence de l'église, the presence of a church and its reality, perhaps through long years of waiting, with no visible sign of any results whatsoever, and in the end these people whom Charles de Foucault had loved and among whom he'd lived rose up and murdered him in a sudden excess of religious fanaticism, and of course the world said, to what purpose was this waste? So in the pioneer fields, but also in the settled fields, it takes a long time before our friends in the younger churches give you their confidence. I usually say 7 years, like the period which Jacob served for Rachel. And if you're prepared to serve 7 years, patiently, in the face of a good deal of criticism and even hostility, then you find you're in. And once they've given you their confidence, it is never taken away. But it has to be earned, and only the man or woman who has patience and willingness to wait will ever earn it. And then there are all kinds of services you can render which cannot be rendered by anyone else. The leaders in our younger churches are often very lonely people. They've been put on an eminence. They find it hard to have friends whom they can talk without reserve and completely openly. That applies, of course, to church presidents and bishops, even in the West, but not quite so exceedingly as to these in their isolation. I often look back again to my great friend Bishop Azariah, a really intimate friend. He was one of the presenting bishops of my Episcopal consecration. We usually addressed one another by the names of our dioceses. That seemed odd to non-Anglican friends, quite natural to us. I write him as my dear Dornicle. Once in the Eternal Bible Revision Committee, where we worked together very closely, without thinking, I leaned across the table and addressed him as Azariah. Now, by Indian standards, that is a grave breach of courtesy. In India, no younger person ever addresses an older person by his personal name. Azariah was the bishop's baptismal name and not his surname, though his children took it as a kind of surname. I had no business whatever to address him in those personal terms. I didn't notice, but he did. The next time he wrote to me, he wrote, "My dear Stephen, I think this is what you would wish. I noticed last time you addressed me as Azariah. Since Waller died, great Bishop of Madras, I think you are the only person in the world who addresses me in this way." Azariah had the happiness of an utterly devoted and able wife, but even she, by Indian custom, would not address him by his name. He had children, 6 of them, 5 of whom in one way or another entered the service of the church. Yet I felt he was a lonely man who returned to the foreigner, who just because of the distance which he stands from the intimacies and perplexities of the life of a younger church, can sometimes be the trusted and welcome confidant. I fairly often tell the tale of Pastor Xi, the famous Chinese convert, and his European colleague, D.E. Host. Xi was a remarkable man, Confucian scholar, and Confucian scholars are not exactly noted for their humility. And even when Xi became a Christian, the spirit had some fairly hard wrestling to do with the old man, and it was difficult to find anyone who could work with this outstanding Chinese. So they sent him the most powerful man in the mission, D.E. Host, and they lived together and worked together for 10 years, and they had what an American friend of mine once described as a highly non-monotonous life. Host held on in prayer and humility in the face of considerable difficulty and sometimes outright provocation. It isn't always easy to live with these brethren of other races, any more than it's easy to live with one another here in the West. And one day after 10 years, when they were together, she turned to his European friend and said, "Dear brother Host, what should I do without you? And if you have given 10, 15, 20 years the service of a younger church and a leader, or maybe some simple bush pastor or evangelist, or some lay friend in a position of difficulty, turns to you and says, "What should I do without you? You have not lived in vain."
Thank you. I realize time is pretty close for those of you who have early afternoon engagements. However, those of you who can stay, we will allow a few minutes for questions.
You care to take the questions, sir?